34. Of the arrest. The lodgings at which the Pope had placed the Comte d'Evreux and his page sat practically in the shadow of the hulking palace, quite near St. Peter's Church. The series of slanting and hunch-shouldered workers' houses that had occupied the place before had been pulled down 4 years earlier, the lumber carted to the palace and cheerfully burned in its kitchens and beneath its baths. It was as though the palace had eaten them. Pope Clement had continued his predecessor's policy of building up a stone Avignon to replace the wooden one, and the Elysium House was a fine example of the new extravagance. Thomas and Delphine had sequestered themselves in their room, having excused themselves from the midday feast that an English duke was putting on in the courtyard. The sounds of revelry had been floating up to them for nearly an hour, and, as the revellers emptied pitcher after pitcher of the Pope's wine down their gullets, more and more often the Valois and English lords who had once faced each other across battlefields, now united in good-natured mockery, directed at the window of the man they took for the Comte d'Evreux and his Navarrese page. This was precisely what Thomas had feared. Though he bore the face and body of the dead man, he did not share his memories, and the world of high-placed men, though embracing all of Europe, was as small and incestuous as a village. He was dangerously near betraying himself as an impostor.
"Is my Lord of Navarre taken ill?"
shouted the young William Montacute, Earl of Salisbury, in the boxy, snub-nosed French of English nobility.
"For I should have liked to have a wrestle with him."
Delphine used the tip of her comb to trace the hem of a woman's dress on the wall hanging near the window. It was the simple comb of her mother's, brought from Normandy. She had flung the ivory comb from the stag orchard into the muddy street the instant Thomas had given it to her.
"No, my Lord Salisbury, he will not wrestle you. He was only wont to wrestle his little brother until Charles grew a moustache. Now he wrestles other men's wives."
"That is too much, my lord," laughed another Frenchman,
though it was hard to hear him over the horsey guffaws of Sir William, who displayed a foreigner's over-appreciation of French wordplay, as well as an Englishman's amusement at French adultery.
"I but jest. If our good Chrétien would poke his head out his window, he would see that I am all smiles."
Thomas felt vertiginously insulted, and also pleased that the Comte d'Evreux was being insulted.
"Leave him be. He is ill from the other night's excess." "Then how does he propose to face tomorrow's excess?"
A messenger had come the day before, crying the news below every window. Since the plague had killed so many cardinals, a new one was to be created tomorrow night. The celebration would be held outside, in the open courtyard of the palace, and open to all. Now Delphine traced the legs of a knight, skipped chastely past his middle, and rejoined the outline at his belly. Past the tapestry knight, a young girl and her father bent in the field, their faces turned away, gathering sheaves. She traced them, too. It soothed her to keep her hands busy while she waited for a helpful thought to come. For once, Thomas would have been grateful to see the heavy-lidded gaze that meant she was about to use words that were somehow not hers. Neither of them knew quite what to do while waiting for an invitation to see the Pope, an invitation that might not come at all. He shuddered at the thought of trying to stab the false Pope in camera, let alone in front of a table full of knights and a company of guards. "It doesn't matter. I've come here to die."
"Give us at least your head, my Lord of Navarre, so we may know you are not dead,"
shouted up the English Duke.
"You'd better,"
said Delphine, now tracing a little dog. Thomas smoothed his unfamiliar, closely shorn hair and wiped at his beardless chin, before thrusting his head out the window to general applause. He waved a hand at the celebrants. "Come down," one said.
"No," Tomas said. "Our friend is quite correct. I ate more than a young man should at the warrior's feast, and have paid an old man's price for it."
The table below erupted with laughter.
"Where's Don Eduardo de Burgos?" another shouted. "He'll purge it out of you with Jerez."
Tomas swallowed hard at this.
"But," he continued, waving the last comment away, "with temperance and prayer, I should be whole by this evening, if my lord the Earl does not throw me to the ground too roughly."
They laughed again.
"Well, get back to your sick bed," said the Valois, "and no more excuses tonight, though you should send your page down for a bowl of this stew. It'll make a man of him. Oysters, ginger, and pepper."
Tomas made as though to vomit, provoking a cheerful "Ho!" from the table, then withdrew his head and closed the shutter. It was struck by what sounded like a plum. Delphine raised an eyebrow, impressed.
"Now go get us a bowl of that stew," he said.
The soldiers came an hour later. Delphine had eased out of the bindings that flattened her modest unboyishness and sat upon her pallet near the window. The spear was around her neck. Tomas was scraping at the bottom of his bowl with a crust of hard bread, eager to get every drop of the spicy stew. The sound of boots on the stairs froze them both. They looked at one another. These were not the light footsteps of the chamber boys, one of whom, Isnar, had made fast friends with Delphine in her role as page, nor was this a solitary messenger. The knock, though expected, startled Delphine when it came. She squeaked like a mouse. The knock came again. The hand that knocked wore mail.
"Who is it?"
Tomas barked, sounding lordly.
"Servants of His Holiness," said an unimpressed voice. "Now open this door."
This was no invitation. They were discovered. Delphine confirmed her fears by peeking through a hole in the wooden shutters. Two men wearing chainmail and the cross-key emblem of the palace stood in the courtyard below the window, one of them chasing off a kitchen girl who had been clearing up. Both men carried pole axes. Delphine clutched the case that held the spear.
"I'm sick," Tomas said. "My neck is swollen and my throat hurts."
He sneezed loudly as punctuation.
"Amazing how many people we knock for feel the plague coming on. Open the door or I'll break it down. And you won't like your trip to the palace if I do."
Tomas took up his sword and Delphine shook her head at him, wide-eyed.
"What then?" he whispered.
"I don't know, but not that."
The man outside the door flung himself against it. It was a new door and solidly built.
"If you make me axe through this whoring thing, you won't walk out of here. Open this door!"
Delphine's eyes got heavy. After the man yelled, she noticed a light coming from beyond the window. She put her hand over the spear and opened the shutter. The courtyard was gone. The window now gave on the bank of the river, outside the city walls, and it was as if the window had lowered. The drop from the ledge would be easy, not 5 feet. An axe hit the door. The man in the hallway was swearing. Tomas would fight to defend her, but maybe not if she left. He was to let them take him.
"Let them take you,"
she heard herself say.
"Let them take me, Peter. Come on, Delphine. His ear's off. His ear."
She closed her eyes.
"What about Tomas?"
She smelled flowers.
"Another one. Stronger than mine. It would protect her." "What about Tomas?" "Come on, little moon."
She rolled out the window. Tomas still had his sword in his hand, though sheathed. Something like a wing flashed near the window, a very large wing, and Delphine opened the shutter. It had been dark in the room, and the bright daylight dazzled him. An axe hit the door.
"I'm going to break your goddamned legs, do you hear me? I'll drag you there by your balls if you make me chop this whole door up!"
Tomas drew his sword.
"Let them take you," the girl said.
Her cheeks were wet with tears. She turned her face from him. She rolled out the window then, but he never heard her hit the ground. He thought he heard wings. Tomas launched himself into the man who came through the door, thinking to bowl him down, hoping to find a smaller man behind him. He hit the big soldier, but not hard enough. "I thought I had him. I'm in the Comte's body. I am not as strong." The man reeled back against the wall, but gathered himself and gave the Comte d'Evreux the back end of his axe, breaking teeth.
"His body, but I feel it. God!"
He fell. He looked for his sword, but could not find it.
"God!"
They hit him again. He was not dragged to the papal palace by his testicles. He was taken in a cart. After they broke his legs. 35. Of the Doctor. The boy who served the Pope's physician woke from his little bed at the other end of the room and brought a candle over to his master, who whimpered and thrashed in the grips of another nightmare. How many nights in a row had he seen him disturbed by one of these? He knew the physician, Maître de Chauliac, to be a good man, and wondered what devils could trouble one so kind. This was the worst nightmare yet. He leaned close to look, but made sure he did not let the candle drip on the man's full cheeks or big nose. That would be like a story he had told him about a curious woman who drove away an angel. Was it an angel? Maybe just a boy with wings. The maître told him too many stories to keep them all separate.
"Maître,"
he said, but very quietly. He had learned not to wake him in these times, but he dearly wanted to end this particular dream. Did men die of dreams? He would try to remember to ask the doctor in the morning. Not tonight, though. He stood with the candle, ready to light him to whatever the maître might ask him for. Wine, the boy thought. The worst ones always wake him, and he asks me for wine. But if I pour the wine and he does not wake, I shall have to put it back in the jug and clean the goblet so the little bugs don't get in it. Pour the wine, Twister. He took a little enameled goblet from its shelf and poured wine from a pewter jug with three rooster's feet. He was fond of that jug, as he was fond of the smell of wine. Not lately, though. Something was off, like a hint of rot. Had they waited too late to get the grapes in? He had worked as assistant to a baker, and thought to work his way up to being a butler and minding the Pope's fruit cellar at the foot of the kitchen tower. So good was he at ferreting out rottenness. His mother said he had the nose of a dog, but the great doctor had seen what a clever boy he was, and pulled him from the kitchens to replace his former boy, who had died of the plague. Actually, three of the doctor's assistants had died of the plague, but the good doctor had not caught it himself. Not yet, he would have corrected. Or he might have said, Inshallah, a word he had learned from Arab texts. It meant something like, so God be pleased. But Tristan didn't understand why he didn't just say that.
Tristan?
The doctor was sitting up now, his big friendly eyes looking bugged and haunted. He rubbed a hand over them and they regained some of their reason.
Tristan, help me dress.
Yes, maître. Are you sure? It is still long before morning.
Just get my clothes together, please.
The man and the boy went into one of the grand, vaulted hallways of the palace, and the physician stopped, considering. He looked left, in the direction that led to the Pope's bedroom and adjoining study. The boy waited with the candle, looking very much like a small dog waiting for its master to open a door.
"Is the Holy Father well?"
Tristan said.
"No, Tristan. I do not think he is, though I cannot say why. He seems in good health, but he is changed."
"Is it to do with the wine?"
"Excuse me?"
"I thought perhaps the wine. It smells funny."
He looked at the boy and narrowed his eyes, considering and rejecting this premise. He turned on his heel now and went back into his room. Tristan watched, fascinated, as the doctor sorted through the writs in his desk, many of which came directly from the Pope. When he found one that seemed to suit his purpose, he fetched one of his chirurgical knives and, as delicately as though he were cutting live flesh, lifted the two separated parts of the wax seal from it. He then fetched a fresh sheet of parchment and wrote something in a very careful hand. When he had finished, he rolled it and, to the boy's astonishment, heated his knife in the candle flame and used it to graft the two halves of the seal together again.
"I see your mind frothing with questions, and yet, recognizing the delicacy of the situation, you don't ask them. Instead, you watch for yourself and come to your own conclusions. I think you have a future, Tristan. I think you will make yourself very useful."
Now they left again, the boy hurrying to keep up with his master's purposeful steps. He turned right this time and opened a door to a set of stairs the boy knew about, but had been warned never to follow.
"I know you wonder why I'm going to this ghastly place, let alone taking you. The truth is, I cannot say, except that the people who work their art down here are the sort of men who might need two pairs of eyes on them to do the right thing."
A man groaned in the darkness ahead of them. The dungeon. This is the dungeon. They put thieves and sorcerers here. It had not occurred to Tristan, who had the deepest confidence in Maître de Chauliac, to be afraid until just that moment.
"We don't fix men down here, good doctor. We break them. I think you're on the wrong floor."
The dungeons, which had sat in such a state of disuse for the first years of the aptly named Clemence reign, that old carts and tools were stored here, had recently come to life again. Sournois, formerly a blacksmith, had been singled out specifically by this changed and unclement Clement to head up the new nether wing of the palace, which was where the enemies of God's peace would be stored and, when necessary, put to the question. The man hanging from his arms with his ruined legs dangling looked to have been asked a question of some gravity indeed, a question whose answer he could not or would not share. The doctor noted, with some revulsion, that the man had neither nipples nor fingernails, and that his shoulders were out of joint. Yes, this was the man in de Chauliac's dream.
"I'm in the right place. What is that man's name?" "This geezer," Sournois said,
standing up and patting the man's soft belly proprietarily.
"Is no less than a Norman Comte, and a future King of Navarre."
"The Comte d'Evreux," de Chauliac said.
"That's the one,"
Sournois said, sticking a thumb in the man's navel and pinching a handful of fat hard enough to make the barely conscious young fellow groan again.
"Get him down." "And put him where?"
the jailer said, growing suspicious.
"In whatever you intended to remove him with when you were through. He's clearly not walking anywhere."
Chournois got closer to the doctor, but the doctor did not step back.
"I have it from the Holy Father himself that this man is to stay where he is. He's coming by personally before the feast tomorrow.
Might even come tonight.
The doctor was aware of a cold sweat beginning under his robes.
He will not come yet, please, not yet, inshallah.
And I have it from the good Clement that he is to leave with me. You might recognize that seal, the doctor said, handing his parchment to the other,
who recognized his name on the outside and snapped the seal. He frowned and stared at the writ with confusion and distaste.
It says that you are to release your close prisoner to me so that he does not die, which he most certainly will and soon if he keeps swinging from your ceiling. But why is it in Latin? It's always in French for me. I read a little French.
Perhaps His Holiness forgot your lack of education. Shall we wait here for him so we may remind him? Frankly, I don't know if I can save this man, and I would much rather have him die in your care than mine.
Sun Wah put the writ in his pouch.
To hell with that,
he said, and went to fetch a handcart. Tomas was cold. He hurt so badly in so many places that a strange sort of numbness had settled into him. His chief complaint was the cold, which felt as though it would never be out of him. He did not know who the man was that wheeled him out of the oubliettes and through a door meant for horses and carts, but he sensed that he would have died had he remained. Not of his injuries. Something had been coming for him, and he had just escaped. Had he remained, he would not only have died, he would have died spectacularly, horribly. The man with the fly's head would have bitten him. He shivered. He looked up at the man wheeling him, and the man looked down at him with kind eyes. He wanted to ask him who he was, but he didn't have the strength. When he saw that Tomas was still shivering, despite the garments that had been laid across him, the wheeling man stopped and removed his robes, revealing a long shirt that bore the irremovable stains of surgeries. He placed this around Tomas, and Tomas smiled. A doctor, then. He might yet get home to Apontel and see his wife.
Don't speak, the man smiled down at him. You have only one task, and that is to live. See that you do it.
He wanted to tell the doctor to get the arrow out of his tongue, but then he realized that was another doctor, another time. He wanted to ask him if angel's blood was made of egg whites, but that was wrong too. And no wife was waiting for him. He wrinkled up his face as if to cry, but didn't let himself. He lost consciousness. When he came to again, a girl was looking at the wheeling man. He was looking wide-eyed at her, as though he saw something Tomas did not see.
Delphine, was that her name?
Her hair was short.
Remember this boy,
the doctor said to a young man Tomas had not seen before, who also stared wide-eyed at Delphine.
What were they seeing?
Delphine put her fingers to her lips, and the man and the boy left. Now she looked down at Tomas, smiling. Those grey eyes. She cooled his brow with her sleeve, which had been dunked in the Khan.
I'm going to die,
he managed.
You already did die, remember? You're the dead one.
He felt his spirit coming loose, like a ship from its moorings, but she lifted his head and pointed.
Hold on, the girl said. Just for a moment.
She put her hand behind his head and lifted so he could see. Something was coming out of the river, lit by the moon. A man. A man in rusty armor, carrying a sword by the blade, cruciform. A heavily muscled man, with a graying beard and a scarred face.
Him.
He weakly shook the ruined head that was not really his. Tomas de Givrat stepped dripping from the river, eyes closed, a sleepwalker. Delphine got out of the dripping revenant's way, and he came to the cart. Tomas was afraid. Was he already dead? He watched himself bend over, getting closer, dripping on him. He felt very dizzy. The world was going black. He was being kissed now by his own mouth, not as lover's kiss with tongues, but as true lover's kiss, sharing breath. He breathed out of the Comte's lungs and into his own. The ship of his soul lurched away from his false body and into his true one. He opened his eyes. The body of the Comte twitched now, once, then twice, only now it was under him. His mouth, his actual mouth, was on the dead man, and he pulled up. He breathed in, his strong lungs filling with air, his hands clutching, ready to grab weapons or levers or to brace against the pillars of the temple. He was strong again. He ran his hand through his full beard and tugged on his longish hair. He laughed, and Delphine laughed, too, shushing him as he put the doctor's robes on over his cold, wet armor. She now bent and kissed the cheek of the dead man in the cart.
"Give the river back its due," she said.
Tomas tipped the body into the water, and it floated for a moment, and then the darkness took it away. 36. Of the arming and of the vigil.
Isna!
The chamber boy at Elysium House peered out the window and down at the street, the darkness of which still resisted the prying of the low morning sun between the close buildings.
Here, Isna!
He wrinkled his nose and put down the piss pot he had been about to chuck. Was that his new friend, the page? And had not that page served the arrested knight?
Diego!
He called down in a carefully measured whisper.
Yes,
Delphine said. She too was an expert whisperer.
What are you doing here?
He looked behind him to make sure no hand was reaching to yank his ear for idleness.
I need a favor. What is it?
He said,
and be quick.
Why was Diego in his night clothes?
My master's things. Have they been taken? No, the room is as it was. The carpenter is coming tomorrow to fix the door. And my master's horse? In the stables, eating twice his share of hay. The English lord means to take him. Open the door for me. What? I can't. Yes, you can. Open the door and help me fetch out my master's armor and horse.
He looked behind him again.
A horse? They'll hang me for stealing a horse. It's not stealing. The horse belongs to us.
He considered this.
All the same, they'll kill me. Then they'll turn me out, and my father will kill me again. They won't turn you out. You speak French, Italian, and Provençal. How many times have they used you to translate? Just let me in, and I'll do most of it. They'll see you. Not if you distract them. How? I don't know. Fall down the stairs with something loud, a pan or something.
This was beginning to sound fun. He would get a beating, but some things were worth a beating. And he liked the little Spanish page with the French accent, even if he looked a bit like a girl.
Why should I? If you do, I'll give you this ivory comb I found in the street.
He licked his lips. An ivory comb.
It has angels painted on it.
Isna liked angels. In fact, he thought he'd seen one last night. Delphine and Tomas rode past the tanners and parchment makers on the banks of the canal, fed by a branch of the river Sourgue, smelling the stink of their industry. He rode Gibrel, and she rode her little palfrey. The horse felt good under his hips. He thought this might be the last time he ever rode a horse, but he didn't mind. He had died this morning, and he knew what it was now. Tonight would bring more death, probably his. He was ready. This would be worse than Cressy, but sweet where that was bitter. The fine armor he had worn in another body mostly fit him, though the chest was tight and the belly loose. The breastplate and leg armor were all Delphine could get out of the house, so his own rusty chain sat beneath them. He had also left behind the Navarrese surcoat and rode with his breastplate gleaming, though dented, and his head bare. Nobody would take him for the Comte d'Evreux now. They left the city by the Imbert gate, but they did not travel far. In fact, they called at the first large building they found, just by the river. The Franciscan Brotherhood lived in a large, proud building, as befit the large, proud city it served. This did not sit well with all of the brothers, whose attraction to the order had more to do with Christian poverty than ecclesiastic pomp. And yet, here was the capital of Christianity, and here they could do the most to protect their order from charges of heresy. Better to let the popes build them fine churches than to be burned on humble pyres. They allowed the rich to bury their dead in the churchyard, as though the devil were too simple to find a bad onion in good soil, and when the affluent tried to buy back their wasted lives, showering the monks with money from their deathbeds, the brothers used their wealth to spread the word of the impoverished Christ. They never closed their doors to anyone, and their hospitality during these months of pestilence had exacted a heavy toll. Only 7 brothers remained of 40. Brother Albrecht, an Alsatian with the beginnings of cataracts, welcomed the knight and his daughter. He helped them stable their horses. He showed them to a room where they could sleep through midday, and then showed them to the altar of the Virgin, where they could pray. They told him they wished to have strong bodies and pure hearts. They were going to the feast in the courtyard of honor. Some lad of dubious merit was to be given a cardinal's hat. It seemed curious that the knight wished to borrow a friar's habit, but Brother Albrecht was used to the vanities of the worldly. Many men asked to be buried in the brown of St. Francis, as though a feathered stone might fly. Brother Albrecht felt the man's chest and cheeks. Was he preparing himself for the day he would need his hands to read faces as well as hearts? And found no harm in him, but rather a long-buried goodness. So what if he wore rusty armor beneath his shiny breastplate? So what if his beard was unkempt and his fingernails long? Who refuses a gold coin because it has a little mud on it? He gave him the new habit Brother Egidius had never gotten to wear, having caught the pest the day it was given to him. God knew they had more habits now than living men to fill them.
"You're not going to do anything to shame the order, are you?"
"No," the big man said.
"How about you, little one?"
She shook her head, smiling. She had been smiling since she got here. Brother Albrecht understood. Blessed Francis just called some to him. It was getting dark. Delphine took Thomas's sword from its sheath.
"What are you going to do? Break it so I won't hurt anybody?" he joked.
She gave him that dry, tight-lipped headshake he knew so well. Then she did something that made him gasp. She cut her hands on the blade, quite deliberately. She smeared her blood up one side of it and down the other, massaging it into the runnel, on the point, on quillens and pommel, and into every notch it had gathered in the tilt-yard and on the field, and in the furtherance of theft. As if it were a holy oil. "It is." He gasped again, but this was a gasp of recognition. "Jesus, whoring Christ, do I have to watch you every second?"
You bleeding all over my things doesn't help me, you or anybody. Understand?
The thing in the murk had not been bothered by the billhook or the boar spear. It recoiled only when struck by his sword. His sword had killed it. Her blood killed it. Her blood in its heart. The armorer at the Knight Tawny would not touch it.
Christ, what the hell is on this thing?
I killed something foul in a river.
Hey, Jack Mal, you want any of this?
He kissed the bloody sword now and put it in its sheath. She took the spear from its case and gave him that too. He threw his dagger to the floor and wedged the spear into the sheath at the back of his belt. He smiled to think he had just shoved a relic worth the whole of Avignon into a piece of greasy leather near his ass. She bent him down and kissed his cheeks.
Daughter, witch, page, saint, prophet, angel, what are you? What are you? You, Delphine.
What are you? He said.
Two things, I think. But soon I'll be just one.
He shook his head to keep from crying. He could not, he would not watch her be hurt. Not if it meant his soul.
Am I still not to kill anyone?
Not men.
What does that mean?
We won't be facing men.
37. Of the Visitation at Villeneuve. Robert Anicott spent the night before his elevation in a state of bliss, only mildly tempered by the memory of the things he had seen in the vineyard. He ate the game fowl and sausages, and even drank the wine, sweet from its late harvest, and with just a hint of something.
Dead feet, corpses' feet.
Else. The something else was easily forgotten, though it tended to bob back up again, requiring further attention at inattention. So much of life demanded a kind of truce with perceived facts. One could not allow the suffering of the kitchen women, for example, to spoil the taste of capon. Neither would those women trouble themselves about the gnawings of a rat at the summer sausage. Just cut that end off and serve the rest. Silently. He did not know now what he had seen at Châteauneuf-du-Pape. But it did not bear further thought. He had done the right thing warning His Holiness about the little witch.
Goodness came from her. She was benevolent like Matcha, her priest. You betrayed one of your brother's flock. I don't know if she was good or evil. I can't know that.
Another thought that he had to step on from time to time was the knowledge that he was completely unfit for high ecclesiastic office. Oh, he had been a priest briefly. The Pope liked to discuss biblical matters before bed, so it pleased him to seek cubiculars from among the monasteries and minor clergy. Robert's good looks inspired even those not given to love men to a sort of instant warmth and familiarity, and his years under a tyrannical father had clarified his mild, pleasant manner. His bishop had sent the newly minted priest south with Clement in mind. Now so long had passed since his studies that he dreaded the first letter he might be asked to draft, or worse, the first Latin discourse he might be expected to give. He might have despaired were it not for the example of Pierre Roger de Beaufort, the Pope's dull-eyed, fatling nephew, as one of the last batch of cardinals created before the plague rose up. The boy was 18 years old, and had to be reminded hourly to shut his trapezoidal mouth and breathe through his nose. Robert could do as well as he, please God, at least that well. He left the pallet he had set up in the study. He would not bed next to the belly sleeper again, and walked down the spiral stairs to the garden. He had fought with the cardinal after the departure of their guests, making it clear to him that further indecency between them would be unbecoming to his new office. The old man wanted to throw him out on his ear, and would have, but for his fear to displease Pope Clement, who had taken precipitate steps in Robert's favour.
The Holy Father loves me. That is not him, and you know it. I don't know, and I don't care.
He heard one of the Arabs whinny and wondered if it was Gep. He wanted to go and see, but what if the little witch was there again, waiting to reprove him, at best, and perhaps to wither his manhood with some spell? He shuddered at the thought, and steered instead for the olive trees, running his hand through their slender, silver-green leaves, and considering the pitted fruit hanging there. He wandered near the huge stone well, running his finger along its lip. He looked at the sky. The moon had a red edge now, much talked about in the city, like the rim of a drunkard's eye. He did not pretend to understand the caprices of celestial clockwork. If these were, in fact, the end times, there was nothing to be done about it. Something passed in front of the moon, quickly. Not a bird. He felt chill now. The cold hadn't taken long to work through his sleeping gown and cloak. His feet might as well have been bare for the thinness of his slippers. He looked toward the house, drawn to the warmth of the still glowing hearth and the candles in the lower rooms. He would find another cup of wine and try again to sleep. A small silhouette now eclipsed the doorway. Young Vincent, the serving boy, waited for him.
"Père Robert,"
the boy whispered, agitated. While Robert had not held up the wafer in more than 10 years, Père was the best title the boy could hang on his master's concubine.
"Yes?"
"There are men in the house."
Robert's blood ran cold.
"What men?"
"I don't know. It was too dark to see them well."
His mind raced. He remembered the squire whose duty it was to protect the cardinal.
"Where is Guillon?"
"He drank a pitcher to himself tonight. I could not wake him, but I have his sword."
He saw it now. It was nearly as big as the boy.
"Put that down," he said.
He thought of the stable boy, a big lad, and he hurried to the stables, clutching his coat around him. The horses whinnied and tramped about their stables. Something had agitated them. He found the boy, who normally slept like the dead at this time of night, sitting wide-eyed on his shoeing bench. Despite the darkness, he could see the boy's outline and saw that he was gripping a pitchfork.
"Come with me to the house," Robert said. "Vincent thinks he saw something."
The boy shook his head in the near darkness.
"I command you to come with me."
"Command as you like," the boy said in a choked voice. "But I saw something too, and I'm not going near that house."
"You'll force me to tell the cardinal."
"You can tell the devil for all I care, and I think I know where you can find him."
"I command you."
"Get out,"
the boy said, standing now, leveling the pitchfork. Robert got out. Vincent was gone. Robert found the sword the boy had left behind and picked it up, feeling ridiculous. He barely knew how to hold it, let alone swing it at someone. He put it back down. He walked into the house now, going to the dressing area near the kitchen hearth and taking up a carving knife. He clutched it to his chest and stood there, unsure what to do. He listened. Hearing nothing, he made for the stairs, taking them slowly, quietly. He heard a floorboard creak, but not from the staircase. It had come from the cardinal's bedroom. He tried to think of where else he might go and hated his own cowardice. He could go to the falconer's apartment, but what would he say? "I think someone may have broken into the house, but I decided to leave the cardinal and save myself." There was nothing for it but to go and see. He crept down the hallway.
The door stood open, the light from a candle casting a wavering glow. He edged up to the door and peeked in. A man, or something man-shaped, if not man-colored, stood over the cardinal. Impossibly, it had its arm down the cardinal's mouth all the way to the elbow. It looked up at Robert, its mouth full of dirty teeth, its eyes black but somehow luminous. Were there 12 of them? No, 6. Now 2. Its skin blushed from sickly white to baby pink and then began to sag and wrinkle. It was becoming more like the cardinal every instant. It spoke with the cardinal's voice.
"Go back to bed, my darling. Don't leave the house. Be sweet, and you'll get your hat tomorrow."
The cardinal's eyes stared dead at the ceiling. His crammed mouth opened so wide it bled at the corners. His soft neck wrinkled back on itself like gills.
"Please don't make me tell you again."
The cardinal twitched under the thing. Robert dropped the knife and walked away. He lay on his pallet, listening to soft noises coming from the other room. By morning, he had convinced himself he had not heard them. The cardinal came to him near first light, asking if he'd had a bad dream. Yes, he most certainly had. The cardinal pulled him gently into his bedroom, and he allowed it. He allowed everything. Everything seemed normal. Except that Cardinal Cyriac now slept on his back. 38. Of the Rings of Lazarus and of the Bathers. The large hooded friar and the short-haired girl packed in with the poor of Avignon, who flowed toward the palace like a second run of cowls and mantles and hats of many colors. If many wore the clothes of the wealthy dead, all of them bore their own hunger. It made them forget their fear of the great death, or, at least, to concede no more to it than rags held over faces while they pressed in together toward the Pope's table. They had already tasted the Pope's generosity at the Pignotte, but there they got vegetables and bread, and not enough for all. Here, in the square outside the hulking palace, beneath the little pointed towers that jabbed up like goats' horns, the smell of roasted meat maddened them and brought water to their mouths. "At sunset!" the criers had cried. And now they watched the sky in the west. The sun's departure was sweet to many of them already, as it called them every day to lay down hammers, scythes, and buckets, and go to their hearths to eat and tell stories. But this was the first public feast since the pest had fallen on the city. This would be something. As the last pale blue in the sky darkened to indigo, the herald bearing the crossed keys blew a trumpet note, and the doors leading to the courtyard of honor swung back. The crowd surged in, managing not to trample one another, but edging as close to the front as possible for the first pick of the feast. Words came first, of course, words in Latin. Censers swung with strange and heady smoke, words in French about how the coming war would be seen from heaven. Words about Cardinal Anicot, and how the Lord knew his own and called them forward to be raised. Now a commotion rose up. Two men in yellow hats, bearing yellow circles sewn on their breasts, pushed forward, crying for help. They removed their hats. One of the men had dried blood on his head and a face streaked with grime from where he had hastily tried to remove plaster dust with his hand. They were Jews, they said. Children of Abraham and loyal citizens of Avignon. An abomination had risen. Something wicked had broken into the ghetto and was pulling down houses.
"It is made of men! A monster made of men!"
The crowd gasped and, in the silence following their gasp,
Sounds of distress and terror sounded in the distance. The crowd began to mutter.
If we call God a different name, we share the same devil. Help us against him, your holiness. We beg you.
At this, both men went to their knees and extended their hands in supplication. The people in the courtyard began to yell,
Yes!
And,
Help them!
And,
Please!
And they moved and rippled like a living thing wanting to react to threat. The Holy Father stood and calmed them, calling forward a small group of soldiers and speaking privately to their sergeant, whose eyes bugged at what he heard. But then he lowered his head and nodded.
Those are not enough,
the man with the bloodied crown despaired.
You have not seen it.
Cardinal Cyriac stood and said,
If the devil is here, soldiers of the church will give chase to him. If these were the hysterics of a deceived people, they will wish for the devil.
One or two in the crowd laughed, but most were too disturbed by the sincerity and horror of the plea they had heard. Now the soldiers marched off toward the Jewish quarter, bringing the men with them. A woman's scream, far away but distinct, rose up past the new wing of the palace.
If the devil is in their quarter, said the Pope, perhaps this will be the argument that leads them to recognize that their Messiah awaits their recognition and stands ready to help them against him whose bidding they have foolishly done for so long.
Musicians came with drum and cornemuse, covering any further noise from beyond the walls. And now, at a nod from the Pope's steward, soldiers near the front uncrossed their pole arms and let the crowd flow past them at something more than a walk, but less than a run. The large friar waited patiently, letting others go before him. He favored his right side, curling around what might have been some stiffness or some painfully withered limb, which he kept beneath his large habit. The girl he had entered with had slipped away some time ago, and no eye had followed her where she went. Delphine made her way first into the garden, with its smells of night flowers and the calls of strange birds, and she skimmed the wall until she came to a door at the bottom of a tower.
Is it here?
Yes. She kissed the iron lock, and the studded door swung open. The room she entered served as a storehouse for the Pope's wine. Candles flickered on sconces. It would not be long before the butler's boy came to tend them, revealing graceful vaulted ceilings in the same exquisite limestone that composed the rest of the palace. Barrels hunched together, looking short beneath this ceiling, though each of them was taller than she. She stepped uncertainly to one barrel, laying her cheek against its cool oak and listening.
Quem querites?
The cool walls seemed to ask.
Whom do you seek? You won't hear anything. Feel him.
She now crawled on top of one of the huge tuns and curled on it like a kitten settling in for a nap.
Not this one.
She did this again and again until she came to one very near the back, one that had been waiting since August.
Here. He's here. You can't do this. You can't. This is a dream.
She looked around and saw a rack of tools, pulling out a prying bar that felt much too heavy for her.
I'm too weak. No, little moon, not tonight. We're coming. Our strength is yours.
She lifted the bar and brought it down with great force, nearly falling in as the lid began to give. She laughed at herself and stood on a neighboring tun to finish. She got the lid off, throwing the broken disc aside, and a sour, sweet wall of scent hit her. The wine looked black, splinters floating in it.
Say rise.
She opened her mouth, but no sound came out.
Say it, he will hear.
That cunt from Paris is in the cellar with him.
Hurry! Rise!
she whispered. Nothing. At first. Then a ripple. Nothing. Another ripple. Then a white finger. The hand followed it. Pinkish white, waxy, shocking beneath its splendid rings. She took it in hers.
God, don't let it come apart in my hand. I can't take it. I can't.
It squeezed. The night in August, he could not sleep. The braziers on either side of him lit his bedroom with a fierce light, illuminating the curls and spirals of the fresco of the oak tree that embraced all four walls. Squirrels and birds perched there, and acorns, all on the slender branches that looped over a frescoed sky of the rarest blue. Pierre Roger, known as Clément, was sweating in his silk sleeping gown, the cord of his sleeping cap wet beneath his chin. He called for Lucas, his cubicular, to bring him a little watered wine. The young man, an angelic blonde from Bordeaux, had been charged by Maître de Chauliac not only to keep the braziers hot enough so fire might be seen, this to keep the Holy Father free of plague, no matter how uncomfortable the heat, but also, and more urgently, to watch that neither coverlet nor pillow should be pushed by sleeping hand or knee into the flame. This was the hottest night since the fires had been prescribed. Clément felt he was suffocating and said as much, but then said, "Yet I withdraw my complaint. It is not for you to choose between love for me or fidelity to my good doctor's instruction, is it, Lucas?"
"My first loyalty is to you."
"And mine is to God, whom I serve through ministering to his flock, and whom the doctor serves through ministering to me. It will not do for me to defy God's purpose by thwarting another of his servants, will it, Lucas?"
"Yet it seems to me, Holy Father, that by this argument, no two Christians might honestly disagree. Could God not be served in different ways by men with different minds?"
the young man said, wiping sweat from his face with his sleeve.
"Ah, not wholly unsound. But your discomfort skews your argument, for you want the fires out. The maître's métier is fighting illness, a field in which I am ignorant. Humility demands submission to those who know best. Keep the fires lit. I will go and nap in the room of the stag until I can stand to return."
His feet probed for the floor. Lucas rushed to bring his slippers, but he waved the young man off.
"The tiles are cooler than the air. My feet shall be grateful to feel them."
Clément shuffled through the stone connecting room with its staircase and then into his private study, fitted out with a small second bed for when he tired of the grand canopied one in the bedroom. The walls of this room gave it its name, for its frescoes sang the glories of the hunt, not only of the stag, but of all manner of game. A man in party-colored clothes let loose a ferret on a rabbit. Fishermen dangled nets over an embarrassment of fish. A naughty-looking boy took birds at the top of a tree. Some had grumbled that the Pope should look upon scenes from Scripture rather than the delights of hunting and bathing and birding. But he had said, "God made earthly pleasures too, which may be enjoyed without sin. Shall I affront him with pride by thinking myself above them?" Celeste was waiting for him. Clothed modestly, as she always was, so that they might more easily separate and look guiltless at the sound of the far door opening. Might not a young woman privately visit her uncle by marriage to discuss a matter of Christian law? And as for sounds of pleasure, castle walls treat the ears capriciously. Do you know what you risk with this accusation? Are you very, very sure? The entrance from the bedroom was safe. Lucas knew never to enter the room of the stag, and he was not so dull as not to know why.
"They call it the room of the stag because that is where His Holiness mounts horns on his nephew's head,"
as he told his friend, the second falconer, and other friends besides.
when, with one warm backward glance, Celeste slipped barefoot down the stairs between the rooms, her kirtle smoothed, if damp, her question of Christian law duly answered. Clement lay back on the bed, enjoying the air coming in through the window. Not cool, perhaps, but mild. A breeze from paradise itself, compared with the furnace raging in his bedroom. Sleep would come now. It began to, at least. At first he wove a nightmare for himself. Four soldiers of low rank and rust were on the verge of raping a girl in a barn. A donkey hung half-eaten from the roof. Flies everywhere. He woke. The sound of high, girlish laughter had awakened him. But whose? And what a dream. Guilt for his carnal sin, no doubt. The four soldiers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, teaching him the grotesquerie of his adultery with his niece by marriage, and the ass from Bethlehem, or Palm Sunday, too. He exhaled, considered returning to his proper bed. No, cooler here. Poor Lucas sweating in there. But he'll sneak out soon enough. He closed his eyes again. He slipped into a pleasant dream of children laughing. What children? Oh, those. The tittering came from the wall next to him, where four boyish girls, or girlish boys, played and cooled their plump feet in frescoed waters. Not his favorite part of the painting, easy to overlook. He had never really seen them before, these putti, as they appeared to him in this nascent dream. So vivid and so happy. He liked them very much. That youth's endless pleasures must end had not occurred to the bathers, and he felt now that they were right. He saw, in the nave of his mind, one of them look at him with the shared secret wisdom of immortality. Out of the corner of the eye, as befit the sly nature of the secret. He or she drew his or her feet out of the stream and stood on the bed next to Clement. The weight of the painted child was real somehow pressed down the bed. More tittering. Those watching from the wall. Now that cherubic face bent to his, and he smiled in his half-sleep. But the child's hand took his cheeks and made him soften his mouth, the better to receive the kiss. And what a kiss! It was spearmint and fennel. It was brandied and onioned and wild. It was water and the mark water leaves when it retreats from sand. Celeste, he wanted to say, both her name and how this kiss tasted, celestial. An earthly pleasure upside down with its feet hung in stars. But he could not speak, for he could not breathe. This became urgent. He pushed the bather's face away, and the boy-girl shrugged and returned to its fellows, one of whom bent to kiss it even more intimately. Clement woke, gasping for air. He looked and saw the fresco, which lay as it had been made, motionless save for the guttering of the candle that illumined it, and mute. His lips tingled, though. What of that? Celeste? He said. Nothing. Only the sound of a fly. He looked at the painting again, and saw that he had been mistaken. It was not as it had been. He counted three children, not four. He put his hand on the bed next to him and found it wet, whether from the loins of his niece or the feet of the bather, he was unsure. Enough of this. He would return to his canopied bed and to the companionship of his cubicula. He got to his feet in the shimmering near darkness and felt water under them, as if something had dripped across the floor. He took another step, but instinct slowed this one. He nearly started out of his skin to see it standing near the doorway. A child, neither boy nor girl, but both, its skin pale, its feet wet. It put a finger to its lips, but the man was too frightened to speak.
It pointed at the candle, which went out, though moonlight still lit the room enough for him to see it walking toward him. Pierre Roger went to cross himself, but his arm cramped and froze in the third position. The useless claw of his right hand stuck to his left breast. He backed up away from the boy-girl until his legs bumped against the frame of his bed, the sound of a dog licking. He half-turned to see one of the bathers on all fours, spider-like, lapping at the love stain on the sheet. He inhaled a gasp of air, but another child, standing on the bed behind him, stoppered his mouth with a cool hand, aborting his shout in a spasm. They pulled him down on the bed. The one who had kissed him straddled him now, fluidly but with a boulder's weight. Can God make something he can't lift? Its black eyes asked him. Now its arm down his throat, tearing his mouth. He could not breathe. He did not breathe again. Until. He sat up from his bath. A small hand held his. He could not see, and then he could. Only shapes at first, but his eyes were clearing. He could not tell who had his hand. He needed to breathe out, but could not. His lungs were heavy and full. He tried twice before he managed to empty them. The dead man sat up. He expressed thick, dark wine from his nose and mouth. Delphine wrinkled her nose in disgust as it washed over her feet where she crouched on the neighboring barrel, but she did not let him go. His skin had the consistency of roseate wax. Yes, he was a giant wax doll who had been held too close to a fire so that the features sagged and melted just a bit. She had to get him out of the barrel. God, the stink. The wine had covered it, sealed it, but no more. She felt ill. Hurry! She pulled, afraid that his arm would come off, but though it did not, he was too heavy for her to lift alone. She tried again, feeling more strength in her, and nearly got him out. He lifted his head and blinked what was left of his eyes at her. Then his eyes became whole. His features shifted and tightened. He saw her for the first time. Terror filled his eyes. Not terror of her, but of what he had seen before. She pulled again with all her might, and this time he helped her. He clambered out in a great rush of wine, kneeing his way to the barrel next to her. He covered his nakedness and shuddered, his mouth open, drool coming from it, but it was a living mouth now. His teeth were purple. When he spoke, he panted between words.
I was in hell.
You still are.
Are you an angel?
No, but there's one here, and more are coming.
Good,
he said, crying, looking like a pale adult toddler.
That's good.
Maybe we won't think so. The war is coming with them.